Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ant's Battle for Bikini Bottom has some unsavory words in its data. There's an unused file that would put SpongeBob into a level early in development named shit.plyr. The file doesn't tell the game where SpongeBob's textures are, so it loads SpongeBob as a blank, black object. Fans also found crude development text by emulating the game. If the game is run on the Dolphin emulator and the player loses all of their underwear, the game log will show decrement time equals 0, dash dash, as saved. This, however, is nothing compared to the lewd content attached to the game SpongeBob Super Sponge. Super Sponge was made by Climax, a British game developer that closed down multiple branches in 2008. When these branches were cleaned out, the contents of their offices were sold off and bought by collectors. This included two backup discs of the development environment for Super Sponge, which contained all manner of game assets, design documents, and concept art. Among the game's concept art are three images titled Naughty 00, 01, and 02. These images depict SpongeBob performing an intimate act on Patrick, Patrick performing a similar act on Sandy, and SpongeBob in full bondage attire. Another folder contains art for the residents of Bikini Bottom. Files for two elderly residents are inappropriately named Old B**ard and Old B**ch. There's even a file within the backup titled SpongeBob Shitless.doc, where a seemingly disappointed developer criticizes many aspects of the game. They list everything that was unfinished at the time and present ways that each element should be implemented or improved. Other documents in the backup give an idea of the team's design philosophy. One document is called Overview of Yoshi's Island and breaks down the gameplay and variety of obstacles in Super Mario World 2 Yoshi's Island. It seems that Yoshi's Island somewhat inspired Super Sponge, and this breakdown was to help the team understand what a platformer needs. One folder in the backup has a selection of ROMs and emulators for the original Nintendo, Super Nintendo, and Sega Genesis. Most of the games are action titles and platformers, which may have served as reference during development. There's also a directory in the backup titled Nickelodeon, which seems to be a collection of assets sent to the developers by Nick. Within it, there's a folder that developers have sarcastically named New SpongeBob SquarePants, Like We Care. Another directory contains several FMVs, including a trailer for the Rugrats in Paris movie. It seems this trailer was planned to appear in the game in some form to promote the movie. It's unlikely the video was there to test playback of full motion video, as a full FMV intro for the game had already been in the folder for 6 weeks before the Rugrats video had been added. Based on files in the backup, it seems the game was originally planned to have a much greater focus on 3D graphics. Many objects which have 3D models in the backup ended up appearing as 2D sprites in the final game. This includes SpongeBob himself, who ended up as a pre-rendered stylized sprite in the final game, but appeared much more 3D in early builds. Speaking of 3D, there was also a rumor that a Nintendo 64 version of Super Sponge was in development at some point. However, the documents in the backup repeatedly mention PlayStation and Game Boy Advance, and never mention the N64. For over 5 years, many SpongeBob fans were unable to play the Xbox Live Arcade game Underpants Slam. This is because the game was delisted from the Xbox Marketplace, making it impossible to play if it hadn't already been purchased and downloaded before January 7th, 2013. Game preservationists said Lost Media Wiki published a copy of the game in 2016, but a legitimate way to play the game wouldn't come around for another 2 years, when, in September 2018, the game was officially relisted on the Xbox Marketplace. Although the game was unavailable for several years, one SpongeBob game has been officially unavailable for an entire decade. SpongeBob SquarePants Saves the Krusty Krab 3D was a 3D platformer for the PC, distributed on Nick.com in 2002. In the game, the player would collect Krabby Patties as either SpongeBob, Patrick, or Squidward against the clock. The title became unavailable in 2009 when the Nick Arcade shut down. Preservationists have since found a copy of the game and distributed it online, but it will likely never be released again in any official capacity. Several SpongeBob games have hidden or unused content. SpongeBob SquarePants Revenge of the Flying Dutchman for the GameCube was originally planned to connect to the Game Boy Advance version of the game. The GameCube game has unused audio that alludes to a Jellyfish Rodeo minigame that's also present in the GBA version, as well as a recording of the French narrator telling the player to connect to the GBA or insert their GBA game pack. But if the player only had the GameCube game, they could still connect their GBA to view a minimap showing treasure locations. In the Nintendo Wii version of SpongeBob's Boating Bash, there are 14 mugshots hidden in the game's data, presumably of the developers' faces. There's another selfie-styled photo of a developer in the Nintendo DS version of the game. While the Wii mugshots have clear reason to be there, the DS image appears to have been taken as a test of the DSi camera. The Nick.com web game Squidward Sizzle and Scare has a reference to the Game Grumps YouTube channel within its data. In the game's translation underscore en.xml file, there's a line of text that reads, "Seven Asses." This is a reference to Part 8 of the Game Grumps' original Mega Man 7 Let's Play, where the Grumps joke that Mega Man gets seven asses. Other SpongeBob games have Easter eggs within the game itself. In SpongeBob SquarePants Creature from the Krusty Krab, there are small fish hidden throughout the game that the player cannot interact with. These fish are in fact a nod to Team Rockfish, who created the game's graphics. Another reference to them can be found in the cheat menu, where entering Rockfish will award the player 30,000 coins. Continuing the Easter egg, Rockfish can be found throughout SpongeBob Atlantis SquarePants, which Rockfish also worked on. Other games also have references to SpongeBob, including the 2015 RPG Undertale. Undertale has many error messages within its data, some of which are attached to character dialogue. The character Burger Pants has an error message associated with them that seems to be a reference to the SpongeBob SquarePants movie. The line is, "I am a goofy goober, yeah, this error message."
Did you know? Over the course of The Simpsons' 28 seasons, the show has lent its name to even more games. The first Simpsons game, Bart vs. the Space Mutants, was released in 1991 and closely resembles the plot of John Carpenter's 1988 film They Live. In the film, professional wrestler Rowdy Roddy Piper finds sunglasses that allow him to see aliens disguised as humans. Similar to They Live, Bart finds X-ray specs that reveal aliens disguised as humans. And just like in the film, Bart has to convince everyone that aliens exist. The game was released on many different platforms, including the NES, Atari ST, Sega Master System, and the Amiga. From July 1991 to September 1992, various Amiga bundles came with the cartoon classics, which included Bart vs. the Space Mutants. For the Amiga version of the game, ARK Developments wanted to make a new intro that better reflected the show's animation. Although each frame was sent to and edited by Simpsons creator Matt Groening, the animation still looked mediocre compared to the show. Another early entry was the Simpsons arcade game, developed by Konami and tested by Konami of America near Chicago. Following the success of the 1989 Ninja Turtles arcade game, Konami took the Turtles' beat-em-up gameplay and applied it to The Simpsons. While there's plenty of familiar content in the game, fans noticed some stark difference from the show. While The Simpsons family sounded like they did on TV, Mr. Burns and Smithers sounded nothing like their characters. This is because Harry Shearer, who voiced over 20 characters including Burns and Smithers, didn't voice any of the game's characters. This is most noticeable during the final boss fight.
Welcome to your grave!
Similarly, fans noticed a lack of another prominent voice, Hank Azaria. Azaria's absence meant that characters such as Moe and Otto were uncharacteristically quiet throughout the game. It's unknown whether their omission was due to availability, budget, or technical constraints. A gag that Konami included in the game were rabbits from Groening's first successful publication, Life in Hell. Published from 1977 to 2012, the comic strip involved anthropomorphic rabbits covering a wide range of themes. While some of the rabbits in the arcade games are enemies, there's another nod to the comic. If Marge is electrocuted, her skeletal silhouette has a pair of rabbit ears. According to Groening, he originally planned for Marge's hair to conceal a pair of large Life in Hell-esque rabbit ears. The ears were set to be revealed in Season 1's finale, but Groening decided to scrap the idea. Another interesting detail is that the Japanese game was notably easier than the international version. The usage of weapons was tweaked and the player's health could go past 100%. Even more surprising is the inclusion of arbitrarily placed atomic bombs, which only appear in the Japanese game. In February of 2012, both Xbox Live and PlayStation Network re-released The Simpsons arcade game. Unfortunately, the title was ultimately removed from both console stores and has not returned. In the early 90s, Bart's Nightmare was published on the Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis to a lukewarm reception. The game's designer, Bill Williams, was a celebrated developer with several acclaimed titles under his belt. Williams suffered from cystic fibrosis and spent much of his time thinking of new ways to experience games. Although he started making out experimental indie games, Williams would eventually take an office job making licensed games at Sculptured Software. While working on Bart's Nightmare, Bill would constantly have to rework the game so it fit executive demands. These orders came from the management of his studio, the Simpsons license holders, and even Nintendo. Unhappy with the corporate environment of the industry, Williams walked away from the project when it was nearly completed. He quit the game industry and enrolled in the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. His goal was to become a pastor, help people, and gain a stronger connection with the world. Sadly, though, Williams passed away at the age of 37 due to his condition. The show itself is well known for parodying pop culture, and this is true for The Simpsons games as well. One of the series' lesser known games, Virtual Springfield, has a secret minigame within the Quickie Mart. As Apu, the player must fight hoodlums using a broom, a shotgun, and an overpowered weapon. With its gibs and presentation, the minigame is an obvious parody of Doom. Some of the games also reference movies. Krusty's Funhouse, for instance, has a password system, with most passwords being the names of Simpsons characters. In the title Super Nintendo version, however, one of the passwords is Joshua, a reference to the Cold War hacking movie War Games. These parodies and references were taken to a new level in the 2000s. In 2005, EA acquired exclusive rights for the Simpsons license. The license acquisition was significant, as it was the first time Fox ever agreed to a long-term exclusive Simpsons game deal. The Simpsons has always been known for its jabs at pop culture, but the new partnership gave rise to a plethora of possible game references. In an interview with Game Almighty, lead designer Greg Rizza stated that he was excited to parody and poke fun at the industry. Unfortunately, not all game developers approved of their properties being parodied, though. During the 2007 Games Convention in Leipzig, Rockstar wasn't happy with Grand Theft Scratchy posters being displayed while they showed off Grand Theft Auto 4. Rockstar ultimately asked EA to pull the posters down. In an interview with CVG, Rizza commented, "I was always under the impression that when you do a parody, it's a sign of respect. If we make fun of Grand Theft Auto, we're not doing it to hurt the sales of Grand Theft Auto. We've definitely had some reactions. We've had to pull stuff from the game." However, other companies like Harmonix and Capcom embraced parodies such as Sitar Hero and Mega Mole Man X. The developers used regular Simpsons show writers Tim Long, Matt Selman, and Matt Warburton to create over 8,000 lines of dialogue for the game. Rizza referred to the Simpsons game as the first playable season of The Simpsons. While the game was the best received in the franchise, things took a sharp turn when EA released The Simpsons Tapped Out. Shortly after the title was released, it was pulled from the iOS App Store due to several problems. This included issues connecting to the servers, excessive bugs, and missing in-app purchases. As a freemium game, Tapped Out received criticism for its exploitative revenue structure and lack of gameplay. The phenomenon of freemium games led to them being mocked in a 2014 episode of South Park entitled "Freemium Isn't Free," where the show's Terrence and Phillip app bears an uncanny resemblance to the layout of Tapped Out. The episode reveals the cycle of enticing players to spend real money to buy in-game currency in order to avoid waiting.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Did you know? The Stick of Truth actually started with what developers Obsidian Entertainment thought would be a prank phone call. South Park creators Trey Parker and Matt Stone wanted to make a proper South Park game where they were heavily involved, and Obsidian was at the top of their list. Obsidian was surprised with how interested Parker and Stone were, especially after Parker surprised them with his extensive knowledge about Obsidian's games like Fallout New Vegas. Parker and Stone's company even financed the Stick of Truth from the very beginning. The final size of the Stick of Truth's team maxed out at around 50 people. New artists had to be hired, as many of Obsidian's artists preferred to work in three dimensions. One of the initial ideas for the Stick of Truth was to make the players sneak past people's home security systems. Parker and Stone mentioned this during the commentary for the season 16 episode Insecurity. The episode in question mocks security systems and was actually inspired by this unused game mechanic. Another way that the game has impacted the series is that, before the Stick of Truth, there was no concrete map of the town. Stone and Parker are both huge fans of RPGs and have several favorites that inspired the Stick of Truth's creation. This includes Skyrim, Paper Mario, Earthbound, and The Legend of Zelda. The duo also said that Paper Mario's visuals influenced the Stick of Truth's look, and that they loved the feeling of Earthbound, particularly how the game gave you control of a kid in a big world where something larger than initially perceived unfolds. The new kid, being a silent protagonist, was somewhat inspired by Link from the Zelda series. Matt and Trey underestimated how complicated making an RPG would be. During a Comic-Con 2013 panel, Parker said, "I really love playing Skyrim, as many people did, so I was like, let's do this, this is easy." Their ambition got the better of them, and they ended up writing a script that was over 850 pages long. Based on Stone's and Parker's aspirations for the game, both the South Park team and developer Obsidian jokingly predicted the game would release sometime in the year 2032. Parker and Stone were urged to cut a sizable amount of the script out and include some of it in future downloadable content. Parker and Stone were extremely against this idea, and instead hoped to use leftover content in future episodes of the show. In the end, though, some fairly notable chunks of the game were cut out. A fight against vampire kids was planned to take place in a church and cemetery, and hippies were also planned to appear as enemies. There were plans to include a giant underground kingdom for both the underpants gnomes and crab people, showing that the two species were at odds with each other. There's still a memorable scene involving gnomes in the final game, but there's only a single crab person that lives in the sewers. There are even plans to create an entire town based on Christmas. Mr. Hankey would reside there, but his home was ultimately downgraded to a tiny house in the sewers. And a giant monkey dragon was planned to appear as a boss. There was also an entire mission involving Ginger Kid. They would have stolen Cartman's precious doll Polly Prissy Pants, prompting Cartman to send the new kid on a quest to retrieve her. There was at least one other cut side quest involving Bebe and the Fortune Catcher. Earlier versions of the game also included five playable classes: Paladin, Wizard, Rogue, Adventurer, and Jew. The final types ended up being Fighter, Thief, Mage, and Jew. In the game's code, there's an unused Cleric class, which may have replaced the Paladin later in development before they cut it entirely. The Stick of Truth's costumes were taken from the 2002 South Park episode The Return of the Fellowship of the Ring to the Two Towers. The episode featured all boys dressing up as characters from the Lord of the Rings universe, with several key events and characters mixed into the narrative. At first, Obsidian created ornate fantasy armors, weapons, and items for the game. Parker and Stone asked Obsidian to scrap the assets and make something that looked much crappier. The duo wanted any equipment to look poorly constructed, so it seemed like they were made by children. South Park Studios also provided Obsidian with full access to the show's archives and art assets. This allowed the developer to include unused Chien Pokemon designs that never made it into any episodes. The Stick of Truth was originally going to be published by THQ, however, THQ went bankrupt during the game's development, and the publishing rights were sold to Ubisoft. South Park's creators didn't know about THQ's situation until they heard it in the news, and were apparently excited when they found out Ubisoft had picked up the rights to the game. Matt and Trey wanted to make sure the show's controversial comedy made it into the game. Stick of Truth's creative consultant, Jordan Thomas, was adamant about giving Parker and Stone as much freedom as possible. Thomas told Destructoid, "The way we looked at humor was, if a moment was a hot button for the audience, should we make it worse? Because Parker and Stone loved to push boundaries, and their default response was definitely not to back down. But the really healthy counterbalance was, can we make it funnier?" And the answer was often yes. It was definitely the right amount of pressure. The final North American version included plenty of adult humor, crazy scenes, and moments you'd expect from South Park. But it was the only version of the game that went completely
completely uncensored. Ubisoft decided to censor the PS3 and Xbox 360 versions of the game in multiple locations around the world. The publisher voluntarily blocked out 6 scenes, calling it a market decision made by Ubisoft EMA. The German version was specifically censored because of the use of swastikas, Nazis, and other Hitler-related imagery. When Parker and Stone found out about this, they decided to insert placeholder images in order to mock the changes. The European versions had certain sections replaced by an image of a disapproving statue with an explicit description of the events that were happening. The placeholder in the Australian version was similar, but featured a koala crying instead of the statue. The leader of Obsidian Entertainment, Fergus Urquhart, recalled the first time he watched the alien probing scene the evening before a meeting with Parker and Stone. Urquhart ultimately thought the scene was funny, but he knew he'd have to talk about it with Matt and Trey, especially when his wife called the scene atrocious. Urquhart told Eurogamer, "I'll be honest, for me that scene is funny as hell, but then it's hard for me to judge other people and whether they feel it should be in a game or not. That's really hard for me." The decision to censor the game was out of Obsidian's hands and ultimately down to Ubisoft, but Urquhart did say he would have stuck his neck out if the censorships would have gone too far, saying, "At some point, if the censorship had gone to even more of an extreme, and particularly if there wasn't a PC version, then I would have gotten more involved, as to say, this is getting ridiculous." Although a lot of the development period was hectic, there were some humorous moments. When Matt and Trey got excited about a quest in meetings, they'd break into character and start improvising dialogue in the kids' voices. Obsidian creative director Chris Avalone said, "Suddenly there'll be Cartman talking about the quest, and they'll be funny about it. You sit back and let them go, and you're like, now I understand how funny this area is going to be."
Did you know? The combat in Fractured But Whole changed to a strategy-based system due to input from South Park creators Matt Stone and Trey Parker. Matt and Trey wanted to keep the turn-based combat from Stick of Truth, but also wanted players to fight in the same place they were exploring rather than switch to a generic battle area. However, testing this idea led to some minor disorientation for players. Since the backgrounds were the same ones used to explore the world, players also expected to be able to move around the screen while fighting. The team tried adding movement, which essentially changed the combat into a tactic style. When development began on a Stick of Truth sequel, Parker and Stone wanted to continue the story of the game's player-created main character, the New Kid. Specifically, they wanted to build on the New Kid's farting abilities and thought about making farts a key element of the story and a means of time travel. Because of this, the original working title for the game was South Park: The Butthole of Time. When Parker told this to the higher-ups at Ubisoft, however, the duo were advised to change the title, since Ubisoft warned that major retailers like Target and Walmart would refuse to sell a game with the word butthole in the title. In response, Parker sat at his desk and spent several hours trying to think of how they could somehow sneak the word butthole into the title of the game. Eventually, he came up with the final title for the game, South Park: The Fractured But Whole. The development process of the game proved to be very different from its predecessor. After their experience with the Stick of Truth, Parker and Stone wanted a more active role in the production of The Fractured But Whole. Parker even spent some time watching PewDiePie's videos of the Stick of Truth and took notes on what parts of the game were funny and what parts needed more work. The Fractured But Whole also benefited greatly by moving to Ubisoft's proprietary Snowdrop engine, which was used for games like Tom Clancy's The Division and Mario plus Rabbids Kingdom Battle. The main advantage of this engine was that it allowed the South Park team to import assets directly from the show, which uses Maya, into the game. This eased the work of the game's designers, but it also allowed production of the game to mirror the production process of the show, which is notorious for being extremely fast-paced and featuring multitudes of last-minute changes. As a result, the script for The Fractured But Whole was able to stay topical and relevant, satirizing things that happened only a couple of months before the game's release. The script for the game was massive, with the final draft weighing in at 360 pages with over 30,000 lines of dialogue, making it almost twice as large as the script for The Stick of Truth and about 3 or 4 times longer than the average Hollywood movie script. However, the same collaborative process that helped ease the game's development also ended up causing some problems for the team. Recording the characters' voices was left until near the end of development, and the majority of the characters were voiced by Parker and Stone themselves. With only days of production left and 10,000 lines yet to be recorded, Parker suddenly fell ill and had to undergo emergency surgery to remove his gallbladder, leaving him hospitalized. Parker managed to convince his doctor to give him temporary leave from the hospital so he could finish recording. When executive producer of South Park, Frank Agnone, saw how exhausted Parker was, he advised him to return to the hospital. Parker told Agnone, "I just want this game to be sweet. After initially setting a release date of December 2016, The Fractured But Whole was delayed to early 2017. To compensate, Ubisoft announced that anyone who pre-ordered the game would also be able to download The Stick of Truth for free. The Fractured But Whole finally released in October 2017, a few days after the airing of the South Park episode, which served as a prologue to the events of the game's story. Like The Stick of Truth, The Fractured But Whole features a character creator that lets players customize the appearance of the new kid. However, it also added several new options, such as choices for the new kid's race and gender. This race option drew some attention prior to the game's release due to it jokingly being labelled as a difficulty setting. When asked about the feature by Eurogamer, Ubisoft representatives explained that the setting only affects the amount of money the player earns during the game, as well as how other characters speak to the new kid. The gender option also creates a potential retcon for the game's storyline. While the new kid in The Fractured But Whole is established to be the same character in The Stick of Truth, there was no option to play as a female character in the first game. Picking the female option in The Fractured But Whole causes the school's counselor, Mr. Mackey, to call the new kid's parents in confusion as to whether they were actually a girl this whole time during the events of The Stick of Truth. Cool Girl will also claim that she knew the player was a girl since their alter egos met in The Stick of Truth, even though the option to play as a girl in the first game didn't exist. Speaking of Cool Girl, her second normal ability, Phone Destroyer, references another game. It's a nod to the mobile game South Park Phone Destroyer, which actually released after Fractured But Whole. Although many small details of the game were changed between the game's reveal and the final build, one possible change stands out the most. There's unused code in the game implying that Timmy's alter ego, Dr. Timothy, was planned to be a playable character at some point. There's even an unused character sheet for the alter ego which lists his kryptonite as Stairs. The game also has many interesting secrets and Easter eggs. During the opening of The Fractured But Whole, if the player attempts to skip the intro cutscene, Cartman will refuse them, telling the player that they need to watch it. Eventually, if the player keeps attempting to skip the cutscene, Cartman will angrily agree to skip it, but skip straight to the end credits to spite the player. A similar Easter egg can be found early on when the new kid visits Cartman's house and needs to get into the locked basement. Normally, the player needs to go upstairs and read Cartman's diary to find the password to the door. If the player instead goes straight to the basement door and enters the correct password, Cartman will appear in the corner of the screen dressed as the New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick and berate the player for attempting to cheat. This is a reference to past allegations of cheating against Belichick and the Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. Another Easter egg can be found after obtaining the Time Fart ability and traveling to the northeast corner of the world map. The player will find a path leading north blocked by an old man. By luring him to one side and freezing time, the player can push a basket of berries to block his path, and then sneak by and go north to find some hidden collectibles on the way to a lone gas station. The music changes to a retro version of the song Blame Canada from the South Park movie as the player finds that the Canadian border has been walled off. There's also a secret boss hidden in the game. Visiting Freeman's Tacos and attacking Morgan Freeman three times will cause him to attack the new kid, triggering a boss fight, and is one of, if not the most difficult boss in the game.
Did you know? The very first Ninja Turtles game for the NES was also the first Ninja Turtles content to reach Japan. Despite the franchise having not reached the Japanese market yet, Konami published it in Japan before anywhere else. However, it was treated like an entirely different property and went under the name Geki Kame Ninja Den, or Fierce Turtle Ninja Legend. Due to a lack of brand recognition, the game didn't perform as well as in other regions. The Japanese game generally stayed true to the turtle story, with the only big change being that April O'Neil was rewritten as Master Splinter's daughter. When Konami started work on the game, the series was still in its infancy. The team used the comics and a brief overview of the upcoming cartoon as reference material, resulting in the game being a hybrid of sorts. The game's box art was recycled from the second print of Turtles issue number 4. The cover has all four turtles wearing red masks as they do in the comic, but they all have different colored masks in the game itself. The inconsistency led some fans to believe this was a printing error. Released during the height of Turtle Mania, the game sold over 4 million copies and became one of the NES's best-selling titles. The title also appeared on Nintendo's PlayChoice 10 arcade cabinet and was awarded Game of the Year in Nintendo Power magazine. It even helped strengthen the Nintendo brand in PAL regions, which was previously struggling to gain traction. Coming in a bundle with the NES called the Mutant Machine, it boosted console sales 2,000% in Christmas of 1990. According to former marketing director of Nintendo UK, Mike Mike Hayes, the bundle was done against the wishes of Nintendo of America, possibly due to the game being a third-party licensed title. The franchise also went under the name Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles in Britain at the time, due to the word ninja being deemed too violent for a children's property. Ninja Turtles was also the first licensed game to make its way to the Wii's Virtual Console service, but was taken down in 2012 due to the license expiring. It also cost 100 points more than the service's default NES asking price, likely to cover license fees. With the game's triumph on NES, several ports were made to capitalize on the Turtles craze. Rights to a home console version were exclusive to Nintendo, though several PC ports were made for PAL regions to coincide with the home release. In total, 9 PC ports were put out in 1990. The DOS version in particular is known for being hastily put together, and is even more difficult than its NES counterpart. It also has an infamous roadblock in one of the sewer segments, essentially rendering the game unbeatable. A gap that can be easily crossed in the NES game was made larger in the DOS version, and the ceiling was lowered. There's no way to pass this level without cheating, though it was fixed up in the PAL release. Shortly after the NES game was published, the Turtles arcade game came out and was a universal hit. The title helped set the standard for beat-em-up games, and its success allowed Konami to develop several other licensed titles, most notably the Simpsons arcade game. The Turtles arcade game took much more inspiration from the cartoon, though the level featuring April's apartment is a direct reference to issue 10 of the comic. This scene would also be featured in the first movie, which drew heavily from the original source. The NES port of the arcade game came out nearly a year after the initial release, in which time the Turtles film had become a blockbuster. Given the subtitle Ninja Turtles 2, the port was advertised as a follow-up to the film, with the manual mentioning Shredder's defeat at the hands of the Turtles and how he eventually resurfaced. Though the game was downgraded for the NES, Konami compensated by adding new music and levels not present in the arcade game. It also included all new characters who haven't appeared in any other Turtle media, two of which were designed by Turtles co-creator Kevin Eastman. The title also had a tie-in campaign with Pizza Hut in North America, and would include a coupon for a free pan pizza with each game. It also had in-game product placement featuring Pizza Hut's logo, which was removed in future ports and omitted from the Japanese release. This port was also made easier for Japanese players, and had less enemies on screen as well as easier cheat code inputs. The game was also simply called TMNT, giving the franchise a proper introduction to the region. And when the third Turtles game, The Manhattan Project, was released in Japan, it went by the name TMNT 2. Like the first game, Manhattan Project's North American box art was done by Turtles comic artist Michael Dooney, though this time it was tailor-made for the game. Dooney wasn't aware of the game's contents and was only given a brief description of the plot. As a result, the artwork features characters that don't appear in the game, such as Casey Jones and the Triceratons. The game never saw a release in PAL regions, despite heavy promotion and receiving a summer release date. This was possibly because the NES was getting old and the Super Nintendo had come out that same year. This caused some confusion when Ninja Turtles 4 Turtles in Time made its way to PAL regions, as the series had skipped an entire game. Though Manhattan Project was overshadowed, it was still very well received. The soundtrack was a particular standout and was a huge influence on video game composer Jake Kaufman of Shovel Knight fame. Kaufman even cited it as one of the main reasons he pursued a career in composing. Kaufman also said he always wanted to compose for a Ninja Turtles game, and in 2014 he did the soundtrack for Danger of the Ooze, being one of his last projects at WayForward. Ninja Turtles Tournament Fighters released on all three mainline consoles of the time, with each version sporting unique content. The game also marked the first non-comic appearance of Karai and featured two original characters, the more notable of which being Asuka. Fans believed Asuka was made to appeal more to a Japanese audience, but her name was revealed to be Mitsu in a prototype build of the game. This name was shared with a character from the third Turtles movie, which released earlier the same year. Since the third film was critically panned, it seems her name was changed as to not associate her with the film. Asuka also has different sprites in the Japanese version of the game, wearing skimpier clothing as well as having breast physics. Each release of Tournament Fighters features a different turtle on the box art, though since there was no fourth version, Michelangelo was left out. Interestingly, the Game Boy title Radical Rescue, which came out the same time as Tournament Fighters, features Michelangelo as the prominent turtle. Tournament Fighters was also the last Turtles game to be made for the NES, and was Konami's last game for the system. It even saw a release in Europe, despite the Manhattan Project being skipped over in the region 2 years prior. Stranger still, Japan didn't see an NES release of Tournament Fighters at all.
In this episode, we'll be looking at games based on animated series, both Western and Eastern too. And what better way to start the trivia than by making our first fact a JoJo reference? One of Shonen Jump's more popular classics, Naruto, has had many video game adaptations. The PlayStation 2 fighting game, Naruto Shippuden Ultimate Ninja 4, contains a subtle yet undeniable JoJo reference. When playing as Shikamaru Nara, if the player uses his Shadow Possession Jutsu, Shikamaru will force the player into Jonathan Joestar's iconic pose. Perhaps unsurprisingly, this isn't the only time a Naruto game has referenced another anime. In Naruto Shippuden Ultimate Ninja Storm 2, when Naruto is about to finish off Pain with the Rasengan, Naruto can be seen with the image of the currently dead Jiraiya behind him, also performing the Rasengan. This bears a strong resemblance to the Gohan and currently deceased Goku's father-son Kamehameha from Dragon Ball Z during the Cell games. Naruto also does the same thing in Naruto Shippuden Ultimate Ninja Storm 3 when he's wearing Goku's costume and performs his Ultimate Jutsu finish chants. Speaking of Dragon Ball, there's an interesting secret in one of the franchise's Game Boy Advance titles, Dragon Ball Z Buu's Fury. While the game focuses on the Buu portion of the Dragon Ball story, it was apparently set to include a non-canonical story from the Dragon Ball Z animated movies. Within the game's data, near Android 18's Scouter entry are unused Scouter entries for the villains of the series' seventh movie, Dragon Ball Z Super Android 13. Entries for Android's 13, 14, and 15 all read, an evil android created by Dr. Gero's computer. There is also an entry for Super Android 13 which reads, after absorbing the broken parts of androids number 14 and number 15, number 13 transformed into this super android. This inclusion seems to imply that the developers at Webfoot plan to include the storyline as some sort of side quest. And while we're on the subject of Buu's Fury, the game has a sly reference to some of the series' localization differences. When Goku gives a demonstration of Super Saiyan to Majin Buu and Babidi, Buu says, Super Saiyajin? This is a reference to the Japanese name and pronunciation of Saiyans, which is Saiyajin.
Super Saiyajin!
Another popular show with a beloved video game adaptation is Harvey Birdman, Attorney at Law. Pitched as a sort of Phoenix Wright for the world of animated icons, Harvey Birdman was developed for the PS2, PSP, and Wii by High Voltage Software and Ace Attorney's Capcom, and as such, includes several references to Capcom's catalogue. Several members of the Street Fighter cast can be found throughout Harvey Birdman's legal journey, such as a moment in which he accidentally sets Guile's hairdo ablaze, and the appearance of a peacock on the front of a magazine, in reference to T-Hawk. Dulcim also appears when it's revealed that the legal office is going Zen and removing its furniture. Zangief intimidates the lawyer after he claims that Dum Dum is scheming an evil plan, and Ryu's portrait can even be seen on a fake ID card belonging to Peanut with the name Nobuyuki Johnson. Chun-Li also attends Harvey's retirement party as a guest, and lastly, copies of Street Fighter 3 are also mentioned, with an SNES version being destroyed by Avenger. It's also found on Harvey's computer and as an arcade machine. Influenced by Zelda 2 The Adventure of Link, with its overhead world view and side-scrolling levels, it has another Zelda reference. If the player heads to the first dungeon without a sword, Jake will say, "Hey man, it's dangerous to go alone," and then Finn will reply, "What, we're both here?" Jake then proceeds to say, "Nah dude, what I mean is, this place is dangerous to enter without finding your sword first. I'm sure you'll find her soon." This is a direct reference to the classic phrase from the original Legend of Zelda, in which an old man will give Link his sword saying, "It's dangerous to go alone, take this." This isn't the only reference to classic dialogue, as in the third dungeon, the Ice King will cut off a conversation with Finn saying, "But enough talk, have at you." After this encounter, if the player examines the garbage princess, Jake will remark, "A miserable little pile of trash." All of this references the first battle with Dracula in the prologue of Castlevania's Symphony of the Night, in which Dracula proclaims,
"What is a man? A miserable little pile of secrets! But enough talk! How about you?
Alternatively, Adventure Time Explore the Dungeon Because I Don't Know had something deemed not appropriate for the Europeans. When encountering the Flame Princess for the first time, Sheel accused Princess Bubblegum of capturing her, saying,
"You tried to destroy me, you tart!"
This attack was only fully present in the US version of the game, with Flame Princess being cut off by Lumpy Space Princess's next line in Europe, before she says tart.
"You tried to destroy me, you—"
Oh my god! Oh, Flame Princess! You should slap Princess Bubblegum in the face!
This is because the word tart is commonly used as slang for a promiscuous woman or prostitute in Britain. Next up, we're looking at Darkwing Duck. Capcom had made a Darkwing Duck adaptation for the NES back in the late 80s, garnering a favourable response, and helping solidify the company's child-friendly cast of characters with a spot in the video game industry. However, there is some unfortunate news attached to Darkwing Duck. Headcanon, led by Simon Stealth Tomley, had attempted to bring the Darkwing Duck franchise back into the gaming limelight. After their success creating Sonic Mania, Stealth had an encounter with some members of Capcom during an E3 event. They expressed an interest in the idea of bringing the series back, which Stealth said he'd been wanting to create for some time already. With this info, Headcanon quickly worked to make a tech demo for a possible reboot of Darkwing Duck, going on to make a fully functioning concept demo for a single level. While they had initially seen interest from Capcom, it quickly began to disappear, as the company's communication passed from one member of staff to another, before responses dried up entirely. The company had spent a few months creating this demo, perhaps foolishly, considering the lack of contract or firm confirmation of interest by Disney execs, only to find that their work was for nothing. Tomley later said that he was told by a credible source that Disney wouldn't have been interested in the project at the time, so nothing would happen. Headcanon found itself in a tough spot and tried to shift gears on their work so that the efforts they'd put into the pitch weren't entirely in vain. This involved trying to change the game's aesthetic and characters to be based on an original IP known as Vertebreaker, with several new members of staff being brought in, including a friend of this channel to work as the game's lead artist, A+ Start, and Matthew Weeks, one of the artists on the modern Sega Genesis title, Tanglewood. Sadly, after launching a Kickstarter campaign, the team wasn't able to gather enough funds to sustain themselves during a long development period, and as such, the project was cancelled. Tomley wouldn't be able to keep his head above water during development without proper funding, and his work on Sonic Mania was only based on development milestones rather than royalties based on its success. His financial situation wasn't as favourable as many would have you believe, leaving him without the necessary finances to support himself or his team for the game's development. And now it's time for this episode's random piece of trivia, and today we'll be taking a look at David Cage's interactive action adventure, Beyond Two Souls. In a bid to drum up some excitement around the release of their upcoming game, Quantic Dream sent out mock scripts of Beyond Two Souls to numerous video game media outlets as if the game starring Oscar nominee Ellen Page wasn't enough. The scripts themselves were a monstrous 2,000 pages, almost all of which were entirely blank. Supposedly, this was representative of the size of the actual script for the game. Besides the cover, the only writing to be found is on the first page, which reads, "The average film script is 100 pages. At 2,000 pages, this is not your average film script. Beyond Two Souls." The first exclusive PlayStation title to be officially selected for the Tribeca Film Festival. Along with these paper monuments, the developers sent out DVDs featuring 1 minute of Beyond's 1.5 hour screening at Tribeca Film Festival.
Did you know? JoJo's Bizarre Adventure first received a video game adaptation of the manga in early 1993, months before the series was even adapted to anime. Production of the Super Famicom game was overseen by Shinji Hashimoto, who is now the Final Fantasy brand manager at Square Enix. Developed by Winkysoft, the game is an RPG based on the third story arc, Stardust Crusaders, with some minor deviations. The game is presented similarly to point-and-click adventures while while navigating the world, and has unique mechanics such as a biorhythm system, which alters character stats as they become stressed. Before a battle, the player must also select a card, which will change the character's abilities, and battles follow typical turn-based RPG rules. This would be the only time that JoJo appeared as an RPG, as after this, JoJo games were mostly fighters. The first JoJo fighting game was developed by Capcom for the arcade in 1998, and was also based on the Stardust Crusaders arc. JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Heritage of the Future, is an enhanced re-release of the arcade game, which was ported to the PlayStation and Dreamcast in 1998. Heritage was the last game to use Capcom's CPS3 arcade boards, before the company began using Sega's Naomi boards, which had very similar hardware to the Dreamcast. The CPS3 boards were an attempt by Capcom to run multiple games on one board, instead of the standard one game to one board, which would, in theory, save money. The next JoJo game released was GeoGeo's Bizarre Adventure, which launched on the PlayStation 2 in Japan. It was scheduled for worldwide release. However, despite making an appearance at E3, nothing was ever brought to the West. The reason for the cancellation was unknown, but it's speculated that there were copyright issues halting localization. This was also the last JoJo game by Capcom before the rights were picked up by Bandai, now Bandai Namco. The first game under this new rights holder was the Japan-exclusive JoJo's Bizarre Adventure Phantom Blood, developed by Anchor Inc. This was followed by JoJo's Bizarre Adventure All-Star Battle several years later under a different developer, CyberConnect 2. All-Star Battle producer Hiroshi Matsuyama explained that All-Star Battle was conceived partly thanks to the previous JoJo game, Phantom Blood. When that game was finished, Matsuyama's team came up with the idea of a new game involving all the story arcs of the series. This means that All-Star Battle was conceived up to 7 years before its release. All-Star Battle also has several accolades. The game received a perfect score from Japan's famous Famitsu magazine, making JoJo All-Star Battle the only licensed video game to receive a perfect score from Famitsu. The game's special edition also sold out in just 20 minutes after ordering went live on Amazon. To promote the release of All-Star Battle, CyberConnect 2, Namco Bandai, and Lucky Land Communications organized the All-Star Battle League contest. The competition started on July 3rd and went on to August 28th and featured computer-controlled characters competing against each other. The event consisted of 7 groups, which contained 4 to 5 characters in each. 3 characters had the chance to be skipped straight to the final. This was through a cheer campaign, in which fans could vote for their favorite characters via a Twitter link located on the website. The results of the cheer campaign put Dio, Jonathan Joestar, and Josuke Higashikata to the final round. The event was shown over a series of live streams promoting the upcoming game. After 3 final rounds, Jotaro Kujo and Dio fought in the final, with Dio winning. A unique PlayStation 3 theme was released to commemorate his victory. The contest was repeated for the next JoJo game, Eyes of Heaven, and was called the Eyes of Heaven Tournament. Capcom have often referenced JoJo in their titles, with some games having multiple nods within them. In a Famitsu interview with Street Fighter II producer Noritaka Funamizu, Funamizu stated that Guile was modeled after the JoJo character Jean-Pierre Polnareff, particularly his hair. Noritaka also mentioned how Guile's name was derived from Jay Guile, who Polnareff hunts down to avenge his little sister. The book Street Fighter Cross Tekken Artworks also mentions that when Guile's sprites were being drawn, the artist stretched out Guile's hair at the top as a joke, and the change stuck. Another Street Fighter II character references JoJo. According to a Polygon feature, Street Fighter II designer Akira Nishitani states that the idea for Dal Sim's extendable limbs actually came from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Specifically, the idea seems to be based on the Zoom Punch attack, which dislocates and stretches the user's arms. Capcom have continued their appreciation of JoJo, even with more modern franchises, like Monster Hunter. In 2012, Capcom announced that 2 pieces of equipment based on JoJo would be coming to Monster Hunter 3G in the form of DLC. After the update dropped, players could craft a mask based on Harvest, as well as a hammer based on Crazy Diamond. A key developer at Capcom is behind many of the company's JoJo references. Hideki Kamiya seems to be a fan of the series, and has stuck many Easter eggs into his creations. Kamiya used his influence to name the Stars member JoJo Joseph Frost after the JoJo character Joseph Joestar. Kamiya would go on to direct Resident Evil 2, which has another JoJo reference. At the police station in Scenario A, the player meets Marvin Branner. A tag on the locker behind Marvin reads JoJo. After this trivia was mentioned in an early episode of Did You Know Gaming Extra, Kamiya confirmed that this was in fact also a reference to JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, and could even be a reference to Capcom's own JoJo's Bizarre Adventure fighting game, which came out the same year as Resident Evil 2. There's another possible JoJo reference within a Kamiya game. Devil May Cry has a type of enemy called a nobody. It's been pointed out by fans that the faces of the nobodies resemble the stone masks from JoJo. One fan asked Kamiya over Twitter whose idea it was to reference JoJo, and Kamiya implied it was intentional. Kamiya would continue to reference JoJo in his games after leaving Capcom. In Bayonetta, if the player acquires the Infernal Communicator at the Gates of Hell, they'll be able to summon infernal demons known as the Little Devils. The Little Devils are a subtle JoJo reference, alluding to Guido Mista's Sex Pistols. The Sex Pistols are six small creatures, numbered 1 through 7, skipping over number 4. Specifically, the five Little Devils are numbered 1 through 6, skipping over number 2. Both sets of creatures also have their designated numbers engraved on their foreheads. Although many video games have JoJo-related Easter eggs, JoJo games have many references themselves. In JoJo's Bizarre Adventure for arcades, Iggy's second special seems to reference Akuma's Shun Gokusatsu Super Combo from Street Fighter. As well as having a similar animation, the game contains an unused sprite with the kanji Inu on it, which means dog. This was meant to parody the kanji that appears during Akuma's combo. In the English version of All-Star Battle, if Joseph Joestar goes up against Lisa Lisa and wins, he'll say, "Why did it have to come to this? You are tearing me apart, Lisa Lisa." This is a reference to the cult classic terror bad movie, The Room, where Tommy Wiseau's character shouts, "You are tearing me apart, Lisa."
Games adapted from popular anime and manga aren't regularly translated and brought over to the West. This typically happens when a series isn't popular outside of Japan, but sometimes a lack of popularity clearly isn't the case. When an anime becomes popular in the USA, its games will often be localized as well, but one cult anime has two games to its name which the West never saw. That series is Cowboy Bebop. Cowboy Bebop is an anime that follows a crew of space bounty hunters. The group often get themselves into unpredictable situations, leading to some interesting takes on a spacefaring future. The series' first adaptation into a video game was produced by Bandai and was released for the original PlayStation in 1998, which is fitting, as the PlayStation makes a cameo appearance in the series. The game allows you to take control of protagonist Spike Spiegel as he flies his spaceship, the Swordfish 2. The title uses a third-person perspective and has the player chase down bounties through various levels. Each location is set on rails and puts you up against an assortment of enemies along the way. At the end of each track, the player must fight a boss before collecting their reward, and bonus points can be spent between stages on upgrading the ship's weapons. Throughout the game, characters from the show will provide the player with information and tips. The cast are all voiced by their original Japanese voice actors, and the game's soundtrack was even composed by the anime's original composer, Yoko Kanno. Needless to say, the game was inspired by Nintendo's Star Fox series. The title wasn't particularly well received, with many critics citing the game's lack of real flight controls and poor graphics. There's also a total of just 6 levels, making the game very short. During our play of the game, we also felt it lacked the essence of Cowboy Bebop. Throughout the anime, Spike is shown to be foolhardy, but knows when to flee when things get too dangerous. The game pits you up against thousands of ships that are eliminated with ease, a situation that wouldn't take place in the anime. Spike never retorts back to his crew during levels, only during cutscenes, making his personality seem lost during gameplay. It would be 7 years before another Cowboy Bebop game hit the market, once again, never leaving Japan. Translated as Cowboy Bebop, Serenade of Reminiscence, the next game was created by Bandai subsidiary Banpresto. Released in 2005, the Cowboy Bebop world could now be explored as a number of different playable characters in the form of a beat-em-up brawler. The game's developers decided to create an original story exclusively for the title. While the crew are seeking out the overabundance of outlaws with bounties on their heads, the team learn about about the existence of a treasure lost by the famous space pirate Captain H. The captain would steal from the rich and give to the poor, similar to Robin Hood. Spike and Jet have little interest in the treasure and think it'd be impossible to find, and so Faye seeks it out on her own. Meanwhile, Spike meets a wanted music producer who tells him of an unpublished pop song by famous singer Priscilla that was lost to the ages. Another of Priscilla's tracks, the 50-year-old record Diamonds, has made a resurgence in popularity and seems to be played almost everywhere the crew goes. The lost song, titled Pearls, is said to be a song to complement Diamonds. Spike decides to seek out the lost song, only to find the track is linked to the lost treasure in its own way. While Jet is out trying to cash in bounties to fund ship repairs, he encounters the widow of a friend from his policing days at the ISSP. Curious to learn more of his death, Jet decides to investigate the case further. All the while, two rookie bounty hunters, Bianca and Kent, get mixed up with the crew. Faye takes an interest in Kent after learning that he's a descendant of Captain H, and so she hopes that he'll be able to lead her to the treasure. During their hunt, gangs are out to stop the team from taking their wanted leaders, and another organization seems eager to find the mysterious treasure before anybody else. Similar to many episodes of Cowboy Bebop, there are a number of twists along the way. Each of the character stories are intertwined, and we're even given more background to the characters. The game is a mix of several different genres. The game's main focus is on beat-em-up style brawling. The player can combine punches and kicks and use a range of objects to defeat thugs. Intertwined with these fights are gunplay segments that let the player perform bullet time-inspired moves. Throughout stages, the player may also need to perform small portions of investigation to find clues, such as hints towards key codes for locks. A few other gameplay elements are thrown into the mix, such as the player running from danger or piloting a spacecraft. The game also features a stealth-based level and a boat driving segment. Each style of gameplay was reviewed fairly poorly, with critics citing issues such as lackluster controls and a reliance on tedious memorization. One part of the game which was widely praised, however, is the segment where Jet can explore the Bebop. This allowed fans to explore the ship seen throughout the anime. The game manages to portray the overall feeling of the anime series, which is what the original PS1 title lacked. It stays true to the style of the show, only compromising in a few places to suit the gameplay. Several shots throughout the game also pay homage to the original animation. The soundtrack is mostly comprised of tracks taken from the anime series, though three new tracks were created for the game. These tracks would later appear on the final soundtrack for the series titled Cowboy Bebop Tank the Best. The first Cowboy Bebop title on the PlayStation 1 was probably never considered for an international release. In 1998, the anime was yet to become a cult hit in America. However, in 2004, reports online stated that Cowboy Bebop Serenade of Reminiscence was set for an international release. The game was demoed at E3 and was generally well received. Bebop was regularly aired on Adult Swim in the USA at the time, allowing for the series to garner a massive following. However, in 2004, Bandai updated the game's official English website to change the shipping date from fall 2004 to fall 2005, and at the end of 2005, updated it once more to remove the date altogether. How much of the game was localized before its cancellation remains a mystery. We attempted to contact several voice actors who worked on Bebop to see if Bandai ever approached them to work on the game, but we received no response. Because the game was set to release in 2005, Bandai might have thought it was a better investment to pursue titles for the upcoming PlayStation 3 rather than release games for the soon-to-be out-of-date PS2. It's also possible that Bandai saw the game's lukewarm critical reception in the West and decided against publishing a product that had already been labeled as subpar. This would be unusual, however, as the quality of licensed games is usually quite low.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.